Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
After the recent return of U.S. military from Afghanistan, and during the continued deployment of the U.S. military in theaters of action all over the world, this Veterans Day might be the most important and the most poignant in recent memory. I'm Clay Aiken, and this week, Politicon welcomes U.S. Marine Corps veteran, author, and the host of the podcast American Veteran, Unforgettable Stories, Phil Clay. He's here to discuss with us how we can best serve the veterans who've served our country and how hopefully we can come together to serve them. Does our country and do our people do enough for those who have defended us and risked their lives? How can we help those who helped us overseas? And would bringing back more congressional oversight of our wars actually help, or would it just exacerbate our divisions further? And more importantly, how the heck are we going to get along? Now, Did it come out this week or comes out next? When is your book out?
Well, I had a book that came out about a year ago, and I have another book coming out next year. But
I thought it was next. What's the one that's next? The next one.
So I'm doing. I mean,
Missionaries is the one that just came out.
Yes, Missionaries just came out. Yeah.
But you're saying that was last year?
Yeah, it just came out in paperback, right?
Oh, maybe that's what I saw something on. Okay, because Lord knows, I was like, please don't tell me it was last year. My sense of time is completely screwed. Like 2020,
yeah.
I look around and think, wait, I haven't left the house since 2019. Is that true? It feels like it sometimes. Where are you based?
Queens, New York. Yourself?
Okay, but where are you from originally?
White Plains, New York. So,
yeah, so not too far away.
I've come about 35 minutes of driving time in life.
Were you in high school when 9/11 happened, or not quite yet?
I was starting college. I was actually in my a freshman orientation hike, and I was in the woods on the Appalachian Trail on 9/11.
Okay, because I know you're close to my brother's age.
I was born in 1983,
and my brother went in. Okay, he's 85. So I, for some reason, I thought you were a little bit closer. But he went into the Marines also, and he chose to serve in large part because of 9/11, and you know, just being impacted by that. He wasn't in high school during 9/11, but he was in eighth grade, I guess, or was he in high school? Either way, tell me, as I digress, did that have anything to do with your choice to?
It did, in the sense that. That launched two wars, right? Or led us into a position where we're fighting in two wars. So I didn't sign up because of 9/11. I signed up because I wanted to serve my country in some way. In high school, I'd wanted to be a foreign service officer, but I'd be a diplomat. But we were at war in two countries when I was in college. So it seemed like the best way to serve my country was to join the military.
Is that the type of thing that you think kids today think about? I mean, I know obviously my brother wanted to do it, so his Marine recruiter did not have that difficult a job getting him to sign on.
Yeah.
But I think about recruiters, those who are assigned to be recruiters today, and what kind of difficult job they must have. Do you think that there is that sense of national service in today's high school men and women, or young men and young women?
I do think there's a sense of service. It's important to, you know, the younger generation. I think that the kind of calling that I felt, I mean, it's difficult to say, right? Because, you know, I can talk about how immediately after 9/11, a lot of people really did feel like they ought to join, right? And by the time, and I felt that to a certain extent, by the time I actually accepted my commission, Iraq was already not going particularly well, right? And so I think that for a large number of people who joined post 9/11, you know, you're talking about 20 years, a lot of them joined during fairly rocky periods in either one war or the other. And so a lot of them had sort of complicated wars and a complicated public discussion about those wars before they joined. So I don't know. I don't know if it's so different. I do think certainly after the fall of Kabul, that has to have an impact, right? What happened in Afghanistan. It would be interesting to to talk.
Well,
about.
I think about our grandfather. I'll say our because this Veterans Day episode. I'll probably reference my brother a lot, but our grandfather had lost part of his finger when he was a young child. And he used to talk about how upset he was that when it was time to, you know, when they were calling people up for World War II, he was not allowed to go.
Yeah.
He was upset because he had this one. He was like, you don't need that finger. You need the other fingers. And he was not able to go. And obviously, there was no draft during World War II in the U.S., but
there were so many people who...
Well, not like Vietnam, though. Not in the same sense as Vietnam?
It was.
Was there really?
Yeah, a lot of people.
Well, now
don't
I feel like
that.
An idiot.
No, but I
sure as hell didn't. Talk me through that.
It's a common misunderstanding, right? You know, we think of Vietnam as a draftees war because it was so unpopular, right? Uh-huh. And because being drafted felt like such an imposition to force somebody to fight in a war that the public was increasingly turning against. But we did have a draft during World War II.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is ironic because you're right. I always, knowing how my grandfather acted and thought about it and how a lot of people in his generation seemed eager to do their part to serve their country, I guess the draft was maybe not talked about because everybody seemed to want to go. And then, yes, in contrast, Vietnam, I mean, I do know some people who wanted to go to Vietnam, wanted to serve their country, but it was certainly less popular, as you were saying. And I do wonder sometimes what would happen if we found ourselves in a conflict with another country today, a new one, that required people to join. What type of impact the fall of Kabul, as you mentioned, or just the 20 years of controversy surrounding troops in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places has kind of what the impact of that is. I mean, you write a lot about veterans especially. And what do you think the sense is? You're telling me you think that there's not that there still is a desire amongst young people to serve and help in the same way, perhaps, as my grandfather had?
Well, I think people look at military service very differently now, and that's certainly the case. I do think, you know, we're not in the position that we were after Vietnam, right, where there was a lot of sort of stigma. And I do think that, in general, most people respect military service, right? You know, so I took my son out to the Veterans Day Parade today, and two of my three children, out to the Veterans Day Parade today. It was a very warm, kind of wonderful atmosphere. You know, and when the Vietnam veterans, there's a sort of Vietnam veterans group for Vietnam veterans who suffered PTSD. And, you know, when they went by, there were just huge cheers for them. Which was really gratifying to see. At the same time, I think that for understandable reasons, a lot of people don't have a tremendous amount of faith in our political and military leadership to use the lives of young men and women well overseas. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is, that's just naturally going to affect how people think about it and think about military service.
Do we really, though, honestly have a lot of respect for military service? And I know that sounds like a controversial question, but I want to explain it. I mean, Have we been trained to say thank you for your service so much mm-hmm. that it's empty? I mean, I have done probably more research into some veterans' issues than others have because the district I live in yeah. contains Fort Bragg. Right. It also contains one of the largest veterans populations in the country for that reason. And the issues surrounding the amount of service that we provide to former active duty military is pretty embarrassing. And it's certainly not on par with the amount of parades we throw on Veterans Day. It's certainly not on par with the amount of times we say thank you for your service and talk about it in some sort of pretentious, placating way. I mean, where's the disconnect between the amount of talk we have about how much we honor our veterans and the amount of political will that's necessary to actually take care of them?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are pluses and minuses in that regard. You know, there's some veteran benefits that have been passed in the past 20 years that are incredible, right? The new GI Bill is incredible, and it's been wonderful for veterans seeking education. I think it's definitely true that there are veterans who sort of slip through the cracks, who have difficulties that were not adequately, you know, equipped for. I think sometimes, especially in the transition period, it can be very difficult, you know. And you saw this, I mean, you see this after every war, like the transition period is very difficult. After Vietnam, you had, you know, higher rates of unemployment and homelessness and other indicators among the veteran population right after the war. But if you look, you know, 20 years later, the veteran population is actually doing better than the civilian population, right? In terms of overall numbers, right? And you know, I think that veterans have a lot of sort of assets.
Better in what way? Better access to healthcare or better? I mean, exactly. What do you mean? What? How are they doing
in
better
terms
economically?
Economically, metrics like joblessness, you know, unemployment rate, homelessness.
And do the numbers break those veterans down by? What theater yeah. they were in? I mean, are right. we talking about Vietnam veterans doing better economically? Are we talking about
Vietnam? Yeah, I'm talking
Grenada.
Yeah, I'm talking about Vietnam specifically, right? And so, I mean, in some ways, it's not.
So that's a generation that's a generation mm-hmm. though that's also probably in their 60s, maybe right. even lower 70s now. So they're doing better,
right? So
not necessarily because they are veterans, but perhaps because they've had 50 years between their theater and
so
where they are
compared
now.
Compared to the comparable civilian population. So right after Vietnam, they're doing a lot worse than mm-hmm. you know, their age cohort, right? And then gradually they start to make up ground, right? And I think, you know, veteran advocates will sometimes say like veterans, especially people who've been through military discipline and been through, frankly, you know, the chaos and difficulties of war and been able to sort of overcome that, often have a lot of assets that they can bring in the civilian world, right? You know, and then the question is, you know, what about the people who fall through the cracks and why is that transition period so difficult? And I think that that's still something that people struggle with in terms of, you know, how do you take somebody, reintegrate them into the veteran community, especially now. I think one of the things that veterans deal with is, you know, it's a very small percentage of people who serve, right? And so isolation can be a pretty significant thing. You know, I remember one Marine veteran who I'm close with went to college afterwards, but he was the only student veteran that he knew, right? So he was surrounded by 18, 19-year-olds. And, he, you know, he said to me, you know, being a student veteran didn't feel like an experience, it felt like the lack of an experience, right? And I didn't have anybody I could talk to. And I'd hang out with these other kids and they'd tell a story and be like, okay. And I'd tell a story and people would be like, oh my God, you know? And so he felt...
That's also probably why so many veterans tend to stay. There's so many around Fayetteville. There's so many around Bragg. There's so many that stay yeah. around the installation that they were last posted
why
in.
Why it
right?
can be great to be in an area with a lot of veterans. Yeah, for sure.
But a lot of those areas have found ways to make that transition better.
Exactly.
I mean, again, mm-hmm. Sorry to people who are listening near Fort Hood or somewhere mm-hmm. else. You know, you're going to get a lot of North Carolina here with me. But, you know, Fayetteville, Cumberland County, those areas have programs in place to make sure that
yeah.
that veterans have not only access to services, but the community itself is far more enthusiastic about
the community
employing employing veterans.
And
the state of North Carolina incentivizes people to employ veterans because it's the most, well, they say the most military friendly state. Why is that? Why is that not something that is? I guess I'm speaking from frustration, and I wonder if you share it. That we do. There's a lot of lip service paid to thank you for your service. My brother has said 100 times, if he got even one interview for every 10 thank you for your services that he heard, he'd be better off. But, you know, he finds that, you know, we had a really tough conversation a few years ago. I can remember my brother doesn't get emotional at all ever, but he got a little bit frustrated at one point because a job he really wanted to get, he could not get past a certain level at it. And he thought, you know, I spent 4 years and went and fought for the country and put my life at risk. And I thought that when I came home, that would have some value to people. But, you know, it doesn't seem to. That's what frustrates me. Mm-hmm. And I imagine you too. You tell me. The disconnect between thank you for your service and I'm actually going to show you that I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends. Some places are great, right? You know, for example, I've seen that actually in the academic job market, right? I'm an academic. I teach writing at Fairfield. Fairfield, the fact that I was a veteran was one of the reasons that they brought me on board, and they've actively recruited veterans into their program, right?
Because that's part of their mission at Fairfield,
well,
yes.
But they decided to do that, right? The University of Nevada, right? They have a large veteran population, and the school has been active in supporting a veterans group that reaches out to every veteran who comes in. If there's like a veteran who's struggling, they'll pair him up with like a sort of another veteran student who's you know, a little bit further along in their studies who can help them out. They're proactive about reaching out, forming community, and forming support networks for people. At the same time, I've been told to my face in academic job interviews that being a veteran was a negative, right?
Right. So, but that sounds like, I mean, pardon me. I think what Fairfield does, what schools that have that mission, there are several, I think, in the Northeast beyond that focus on that. But that sounds a little bit like segregated opportunity to me. I mean, you're talking about programs that are specifically targeting veterans because University of Virginia won't, or because the University of Kentucky won't, or a lot of other places won't. These are people who volunteered to die, if necessary, for all of us in the country, not just the people at Fairfield, not just the people in Nevada. You know, so why can the government do anything? Can the federal government, can state governments do anything to do a better job of incentivizing these folks incentivizing more schools to do what Fairfield does, or more business owners to hire veterans or give them priority? You seem to be okay. You seem to not be very frustrated about some of these things, which is great if you aren't, because you live it and I don't. So tell me if I don't need to be as pissed as I am.
No, it's not that I'm not frustrated where there are problems. I'm very frustrated where there are problems. I think my hesitancy comes from, lodging a sort of general complaint against sort of Americans as a whole, because I actually think that Americans in general are very supportive. I think that as a general rule, you know, when people are given the opportunity to help, and when they sort of, when they have leaders in their communities who can actually sort of guide people to being productive in certain areas, Americans do tend to step up. And I think that's very true in veterans areas as well. I think that there are, so, you know, I wouldn't want to sort of make a general lament, but I would say that there are certainly cases where we're failing veterans. There are certainly cases where people slip through the cracks. There are certain institutions that are doing a great job, which then calls into question why other people can't emulate that.
You have a podcast, American Veteran,
yes,
or American Veterans, mm-hmm, where you talk about stories, or you let other vets talk about their stories.
Yes.
Do you find that on the whole, more or less, are satisfied with having done what they, you know, had, having made the choice to serve like they did, or
I think, well, most veterans are, right? And this is regardless of how they feel about their wars. I mean, I think that, you know, it's an old poll at this point, but I, you know, something around 89% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans don't regret their decision to join, wouldn't take that back. Even though the support for the wars that they fought in was much lower among that population, right? There were a lot more people with serious mm-hmm. questions about, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan. And I think that's very true. You know, one of the things, so in the podcast, we have a whole range of veterans from, you know, World War II, Vietnam, the present day. And there are people who regret having joined, right? Because I think that the goal of the series is to show a wide diversity, right? A kind of different, just sort of really incredible life stories. But there's some people who, even though they had a very difficult time, so one of the people that tells her story is Shoshana Johnson, who's the first Black female POW, right? And, you know, as she's telling her story and the story of, you know, when she was captured, her time in captivity is incredibly gripping. But also incredibly gripping is, you know, when she came back, and sort of processing that memory and then reaching out to other members of her family who had also served in earlier wars and earlier times, and pushing them to process some of the things that they'd been through. And she says, you know, she does not regret having joined the military. The only thing that she would take back was that day, right? That day that they were ambushed, that some of the people in her unit were killed and that they were, you know, and that's what she would take back, but not having joined, not having, you know, been in the military. And I think that's frequently very common, right?
But her life afterwards, her life yeah. since coming back stateside, she doesn't have issues.
No,
into those types of issues with people?
She talked about issues that she had very frankly and very openly, you know, and you know, some veterans have issues ranging from post-traumatic stress to, you know, just a range of other issues sort of transitioning back into normal life. And then there are some veterans, you know, we talked to one World War II veteran, Edward Field, who became a poet, right? And, you know, he left the service. He got a lot out of the service. He was on a bomber crew and he like volunteered for missions because he found it so exciting, even though it was one of the most dangerous jobs that you could have. 25% of the aircraft that we put into the air in World War II went down. And he credited the military with having exposed him to a broader stretch of life. It exposed him to gay life in the 1940s.
Ironically.
Yeah. he felt like it strengthened him in many ways.
So we are a political podcast, yeah. but we try not to be too political.
Right.
And especially on a subject like this, I don't want to ask you to be more political than you want to be, but do you find that, I've got five questions floating around in my head here, so I'm going to try to get just one of them out at once, at a time. Do you find that there's any sort of commonality amongst veterans you speak to, either on the podcast mm-hmm. or outside of it, when it comes to what they believe our country needs more or less of right now? I'm not going to ask you specifically,
sure.
are there more progressives or are yeah. there more conservatives, but do you find a commonality amongst veterans that their time in service tends to provide veterans with this particular worldview mm. and how we could improve this country?
Well, you know, one thing that I've seen that's interesting among veteran lawmakers
When you say veteran lawmaker, you mean veterans who become lawmakers?
Yes, right. Okay. On both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, is more interest in oversight of Congress. Because one of the things, especially from our generation, that people come back with is this sense that America is not really paying attention to the wars, right? That you're out there fighting, and there are people who don't even know there's a war going on. Mm. And part of that is because we've made political decisions to, you know, Congress doesn't vote on wars anymore, right? We're still using an authorization for the use of military force that was passed in 2001, and we're using it all over the globe, in different continents, you know, killing people in groups that didn't exist in 2001, or that are sort of only very, very loosely tied to anybody that authorization was originally intended to authorize us to you know, go out and kill. And they feel as though there's been a kind of drift in terms of how we do military policy. And this is not something that is simply, you know, Democrat or Republican thing, but I think it's a matter of the amount of serious, sustained moral and political attention that we're paying towards, the amount of oversight that Congress is actually exercising, whether or not we're actually debating what we're doing and why, and how it's, you know, how, what kind of goals we're trying to achieve and whether or not we're achieving them, right? Congress.
Oh, well, come on, Phil, we don't debate shit anyway. So, it's not just these issues. It's all the issues we don't really debate too much.
So you have seen,
we make political decisions.
You know, folks on both sides of the aisle who have pushed for this, you know, Peter Myers, a Republican congressman. I know that Tim Kaine, sort of more oversight has long been something that he's been pushing for. Another thing that I think has crossed political lines beyond just sort of wishing we paid more attention and wishing that we had not just sort of ceded all authority for war making to the president, right? You know, we're killing people in like 6, 7, or 8 countries right now. And Congress has almost no role in those ongoing operations. They all just sort of fall under the same authorization from 2001. But aside from that, I think one thing that I have seen is very important to a lot of veterans of all political persuasions, and I don't mean to speak for every veteran because obviously it's an incredibly diverse group, but evacuating those people who worked for us, whose lives are at risk, is very important, right? So, you know, that the evacuation in Afghanistan, you know, that work is still going on. I was talking to an Afghan SIV who's still stuck in Kabul. SIV is a special immigrant visa. It's the visa that we give to people who worked for us, right? Oftentimes whose lives are at risk because they work for us. This particular guy that I was talking to, you know, he already had to flee his home in 2015 because of death threats from the Taliban. And now he's under more threat, obviously, because the Taliban control the entire country and he's still in Kabul. He's very worried for his children. He has 3 daughters. His wife is pregnant. And, you know, why he's still there, it says a lot about our broken immigration system. It says a lot about the hold on any kind of immigration from Afghanistan that was put in during the Trump years. It says a lot about the failure of the Biden administration to adequately plan for the sort of coming humanitarian catastrophe. And so, you know, and I know vets who have been working, you know, 24/7 on this issue, and it's just kind of heartbreaking.
I mean, well, then let's delve into it, because I know I get the sense you want to talk a little bit more about Afghanistan. So I'm going to play devil's advocate some.
Sure, go for it.
If I can, and ask, is that not one of the arguments that some could make for why Congress might not be able to do the decision making in situations like that? I mean, that certain military actions or diplomatic actions, whatever you want to call the withdrawal, it was obviously a military withdrawal, but are so complex and so multi-layered that trying to get 535 people to discuss them with you don't have time for it. I'm sure you've heard, as has pretty much anybody else who's been awake since the withdrawal this summer, you know, 5, 6, 7 different opinions on how that withdrawal took place, what should have been done or what shouldn't have been done, mostly what shouldn't have been done, very little what should have been. Is that not an argument for leaving that decision, those types of decisions, in the hands of the Commander-in-Chief and the Department of Defense and the Joint Chiefs, et cetera, versus 535 politicians who probably don't know what's going on the ground as much?
Well, what I would say to this is, obviously, like, the, you know, Congress is not going to make tactical decisions, right, about how to execute a policy. But Congress is supposed to be the branch of government that's with the authority for making war, right? And I mean, actually, the founders didn't even want a standing army. They wanted Congress to have to vote every 2 years to keep it up. And we're worried about, but right now we just have a standing war. And so what I would say
assume in the scenario where we did not have reauthorization,
right.
If we didn't have this automatic reauthorization, in the situation where we had to have Congress authorized to maintain troops in Afghanistan, I would assume that at the very least, by 2018, at the very least, certainly probably before then, that authorization probably would have lapsed, right? And Congress would have felt the political pressure from Americans who were tired of being in Afghanistan to deauthorize that action and expect that we come home. So then if that were the case, if Obama said we were going to leave, he was going to get us out and he didn't, and Trump said he was going to get us out and he didn't, right. At some point, the tactical decisions about how to do that would be left up to either Obama, Trump, or Biden. What changes would be made? What changes would you have made or done differently?
If you're going to have ongoing combat operations, if we're going to be killing people around the world, which we're currently doing, I think that even if you think, and there are some of these missions that I think are good where we have troops stationed, right, that I support. But I think that the president should have to come before Congress on a regular basis, maybe every 2 years. But certainly they should have sunset clauses. And I think that if he wants to continue the operation, he should have to make a case. He should have to say why we're putting troops in harm's way, why we're killing people, what we expect to get out of it, what it's going to cost, what the benchmarks of success are going to be, so that if he comes back in 2 years, we can actually see whether or not we've achieved anything that we said we wanted to. And then I think every member of Congress should have to vote on it. Do I think that's going to fix military policy?
Then,
I don't think it's going to fix military policy, but it will at least force some degree of accountability, and it won't just be, military policy happening in the dark with no responsibility to the American public, because this is the most morally fraught thing we do as a nation. And to say that Congress just gets a total pass on it, I don't think it's sustainable for a republic. If we take, our ideas about who we are as a nation seriously, this is the most important thing that we should be regularly voting on.
Right. So, but then what, I guess, because I don't think anything, I said I would try to play devil's advocate. I might have a hard time even playing devil's advocate to what you just said, because I think by and large, a lot of America on both sides of the aisle would probably agree with that. We'd like a little more transparency. We'd like a little bit more. Most people would like a little bit more explanation for why we're doing these things.
But if we had to regularly debate it, people would know we were at war, right? And this gets back to that feeling that the individual veteran has. It maybe doesn't get expressed politically.
Of being forgotten.
But they come back and nobody even knows, right? I was talking to veterans who are in Syria. Right. And they came back. People were like, Syria?
I didn't know we were in Syria.
And it was like, right. Yeah, of course.
But that doesn't get to the actual Afghanistan withdrawal question.
Sure.
Right. Which is, let's assume all of the stuff that you and most people would like, which is,
we want
more transparency, explanation. What would be different? Let's assume Biden went to the Capitol and laid out his plan and they said, nope, you got to pull out. He said, okay, I want to pull out. Yeah. What would be, I guess there's a lot of talk about how much this might affect his legacy in the long term, or how this withdrawal really stains his reputation, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I'm in all the weeks that we've spoken about it with people since this happened, very few have said what they felt should have been done differently, other than we shouldn't leave people behind that worked with us, which everyone, I think, agrees with, but then at the same time, a lot of people say, yeah, but we also need to make sure that nobody's slipping through the cracks who's a terrorist who is able to convince us that they worked with us or helped us, or they helped us 15 years ago, but then they left and then they became, a jihadi and they're using their help from 2005 that they gave us as their reason to get in. So, it's just so multi-layered, right? That's kind of where the question came from. What would be different?
To be perfectly honest, I mean, the people who are coming through, I mean, the amount of vetting that they have is just, it's outrageous. you know, like,
what's better though? Too much vetting? What's worse though? I'm sorry, too much vetting?
I think when, or not I think enough? When you have, when I'm speaking to veterans who owe their lives to people whose lives are at risk, who are being hunted by the Taliban, when I've got veterans, I was speaking to a veteran and there's a woman, she's pleading, she's crying because the Taliban came and they beat her and she's got fluid in her lungs and she's hiding and doctors are hiding her in a hospital because she's on a kill list. And she says, why are our lives not worth saving? When you have another friend of mine who was working, trying to help an Afghan that he tremendously admired, and that guy was murdered. He was murdered 2 weeks ago.
And this is bureaucracy, obviously.
And, you know, at a certain point, it's like, there are people dying. There are people dying who actually put their asses on the line for Americans, right? And we're saying, we are willing to let them die. We are willing to let them live in fear and terror because we are so...
Who's willing?
The American people who those Americans who don't support opening up immigration for these folks, right? Because that is literally what is happening.
So that's it.
Right?
I'm trying to figure out exactly what the issue is. Because I don't think if you tell these stories, most Americans on both sides of the aisle, especially in the weeks after the withdrawal, Republicans were pissed that Biden would dare leave anybody there who tried to help, and Democrats were pissed that people were dying, and yet it was still happening. And I'm trying to figure out, because the news sure as hell hadn't made it clear, is it a bureaucratic issue or is it a desire on the part of someone in the State Department or the Department of Defense to actually not let as many people in?
So, well, during the Trump years, that was certainly the case, right? So we basically shut down immigration from Afghanistan. Right. I mean, like, we literally shut it down. And then even when it opened back up, it was at such a crawl, you know, that it was sort of like, you know, in World War II, under the FDR, I forget the name, the guy who didn't want to let Jews in. Right. But he didn't want to publicly say that America wasn't accepting Jews. And there's a sort of infamous telegram that he sent out where he said the tactic is delay, delay, delay. Right. And so sort of like, you know, you can throw up bureaucratic hurdles that slow things to an absolute crawl. And that's what happened.
Do you think that's still happening now?
So it very much ramped up during the Biden administration. And yet, I mean, there's tons of things that they ought to have done that they did not do, right? And there are things that still can be done, right, that I think they really need to do, right? So I think there should be waivers on certain types of fees. There should be waivers for humanitarian parole and sort of classes of folks by category to actually get them to the United States. And there's a whole host of things that we could do to make this process easier than it has to be. But at the end of the day, you know, part of the problem is we're working with the U.S. immigration system as a whole is broken. It doesn't work during normal times, and this was a crisis, right? You know, during Vietnam, we set up a joint sort of interagency task force to actually deal with refugees from Vietnam. And by the way, we had the same, you know, maybe there's going to be communist infiltrators from Vietnam. We took in tens of thousands of people, more than that. No problems, right? You know, incredible asset to America. What the Vietnamese community has brought to America as you know, in the wake of that decision to let in, you know, large.
Do you think that the fall of Kabul has parallels or is even synonymous with the fall of Saigon?
I mean. Certainly there are similarities, right? It's the losing moment of a war, right? And it's also the occasion when there were a lot.
Was it the losing moment of the Afghan war?
I mean, this is the thing for me, and I supported the withdrawal, right? And I always expected. I think everybody who was paying attention expected that this was going to happen, right? We couldn't have continued fighting there. There are people who would say, oh, if we'd kept 2,500 troops in, we could have kept things stable. It's like, are you kidding me?
Well, they're sitting in their living room watching the football game at the same time they're telling you that, I'm
sure.
It's
insane. I mean, you know, the only time that we really sort of pushed back the Taliban was when we threw in, you know, over 100,000 troops. We had a huge surge of troops, and those gains disappeared like that. Right, the second that we left some of those areas, and then it was sort of steady gains for the Taliban. If you think that 2,500 troops would have kept things stable, you are kidding yourself. And so,
do you think the Afghan war was lost in the same way that a lot of people believe the Vietnam War was?
It was. The Taliban is in charge of the country now. So I don't see any
other
way.
So then who will be remembered for that? Who will be remembered for that? Will it be Biden who's remembered for that? Or will it be Bush or Obama or Trump?
Oh, I think I think all four presidents bear responsibility. I think that Bush...
I mean, I'm sure it won't be tough to ask. It's not going to be a tough question for you, but do you think that most people know who the president was during the fall of Saigon?
It's a good question. I mean, but, you know, I don't think there's anyone, you know, do people blame Kennedy for Vietnam? Do they blame Eisenhower, right?
Well, some people would blame Kennedy since he started it, yeah. but I think most people think of Johnson and Nixon as being the main reasons that Vietnam was a failure. And I have yet to find one person who I've asked who has realized that the fall of Saigon happened under Gerald Ford.
Yep.
So do you think that, I mean, if from a political perspective, had Biden allowed the war to go on for another year, perhaps it would have been a part of his administration, a part of his legacy. He would own the war by pulling out immediately. Did he pull a Gerald Ford and remove his name from being a part of the Afghan war?
I think if he kept troops in longer, it would have been a much more disastrous pullout because the Taliban would have been ramping up attacks. We would have been withdrawing under much worse circumstances. You know, I think that probably a lot of the emphasis is going to be on George Bush because it was, you know, because of the way that we set up the Afghan government. I mean, you know, we set up a government that was never anything more than a kind of, you know, it was our American Western country.
Well, we're very good at doing that as Americans. We're very good at setting up governments that we think are going to work, you know, really well, and then they suck.
Yeah, with not a lot of interest in what was actually sort of, you know, the local power structures in Afghanistan. And so it was always something of a mirage. You know, we could have sunk infinite resources into it for as long as we wanted, and it never would have been able to take off on its own, which is, I mean, it was basically what we did. And so, yeah, so I supported the withdrawal. I think it was the right decision. Right. And so, you know, but sort of slowly drawing down troops that happened over the course of three administrations.
How does it, and the 20 years, and I've kind of asked this before, but I'm going to ask it again, the 20 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq, 20 years in Afghanistan, and the discombobulated withdrawal.
Yeah.
And the lack of attention to the service of men and women who were over there, especially at least in the last 10 years of that war, very little attention paid to it. How will that, or how do you think that does continue to impact the enthusiasm for 17 and 18 year old men and women to want to serve now?
Well, I don't think the fall of Kabul was a good recruiting pitch. But I also don't think that sort of a long-running war that was seen as a failure was a good recruiting pitch either, right? You know, at the very least, I think what you need to do is we needed to end the war, and we actually need to start using our military in a more responsible way that when the average American looks at what we're doing, they can understand, right, how that is related to American national security, American interests, American values, right? Which I think are also really important. You know what?
What are those?
What are them? What, you know, I actually think in the withdrawal, you know, the Marines who were there evacuating people who died in that blast, right? That mission, out of all the missions in Afghanistan, you know, there's so many missions in Afghanistan over the past 20 years that you can point at as ill-conceived, right? That you know, I know guys who, you know, who went into some pretty tough places, right? Only to see, you know, everything turned to nothing, right? But what they were doing at the very end was they were risking their lives to help other people, to save other people, right? I think that is incredibly noble. And,
is that an inherently American value, though, or is that a value inherent in Marines and soldiers and sailors and airmen and women? I mean, what are American values?
I think that there is an image of America that is where values are core to our identity, values like liberty, equality, right? The sort of, you know, what Ralph Ellison describes as sort of sacred words of American democratic life that we're always sort of, you know, violating and then trying to sort of, you know, go back and live up to. I think a certain degree of openness, right? Like they were risking their lives for people, a lot of them, you know, from another country, looked different from a lot of us, practiced a different religion from a lot of us, and yet nevertheless, they felt a commonality and a responsibility to these people who they had, you know, who in many cases had helped Americans, had served with Americans. And I think that degree of openness and open-heartedness is America at its best, at its best.
Do you think Americans feel that way? I mean, it sounds like you're talking about this image of America from outside America, mm-hmm. that's how we yeah. are and should be. Do you think that the current population of the U.S. feels like that's what our values should be or are?
I think it's our job to make that America a reality, right? And I think that, you know, I really do, you know? And I think—
Are we doing well with that right now, Phil?
You know,
how are we doing?
You know, I was talking to a vet who was doing these evacuations, right? And he was just destroyed. He was an Afghan vet, right? Afghan infantry vet in the Marines. And during the time, I mean, he was so distraught. It was just a brutal process, right? Because you're trying everything you can. And there are people who, you know, you really think, you know, why can't I bring these people over? And he'd sort of feel like, you know, what was the right form? What didn't I fill out? Who didn't I contact? And then I talked to him recently, and he was helping a family move in, refugee family move in. And he lives in St. Louis. And he's like, a lot of people came out, a lot of people, you know, because currently there's you're taking people from a foreign country. They left with, you know, just what they could carry. They don't have anything. And there's not a lot of funds to actually get people up on their feet when they come to America. And the community in St. Louis has really stepped up. And he said, you know, all these years, I thought Americans didn't care about Afghanistan. But all these people, you know, they saw something that they recognized was wrong, that was happening. And when they were given an opportunity to actually step up and try and reach out and help another person, they came forward. So I think you do still find those elements of the American character, right? And they're, you know, it's not just expressed in refugee issues. It's just on my mind because I've been speaking with Afghans and people working in the evacuation space. So, and they're incredibly heartbreaking stories. So that's what I'm, you know, I have it very much top of mind. But I think there's a lot of avenues where Americans do that. And I think that, you know, and this is why I talk about values. You know, it's not just enough that I think, you know, people don't just want to see that our military is not losing wars, right? They want to have faith that our military leaders and political leaders know what they're doing, that they're being responsible. But I think they also, you know, they want the military to be doing things that we as Americans feel pride in, and that help call us to our best sense of ourselves, right? And that's ultimately, you know, so it's very funny, right? So, you know, like a lot of people are talking about China right now, and we have a more powerful military than China, but whatever, you know, if we're rattling sabers at China and China's rattling sabers at us, I think that's a confrontation that China probably feels very confident in. Our advantage over a country like China are the advantages of an open society, right? And I think that the things that appeal to people about America, that give us added strength, are related to the basic fundamental ideals of American democracy, you know, going back to the founding.
God, I so want to follow up on that, but I'm gonna get in trouble if I don't get some of these questions from I really want to ask you if they're really that, if they're making us strong, those values are making us stronger, that open society thing. I'm going to get to Tina from, we had some really good questions come in for you this week because people, a lot of specific things, especially from veterans. Mm-hmm. But this one's not from one, or I don't think it is. Sorry, Tina. Tina from Atlanta. Asks, did we lose something when we lost the sense that war and soldiering had an element of glory and destiny in the popular imagination?
Well, I don't think we've lost the sense of glory. I mean, I think that sometimes our sense of where that glory lies is a little bit misplaced, right? So if you think of like, a lot of the popular culture things about the recent wars have focused on lethality, right? Like the deadliest sniper or what have you.
Right. You're talking about what we see in the zeitgeist, the movies, the TV shows that focus on these things.
Whereas what the nobility of soldiering is not in willingness to kill, right? It's in willingness to sacrifice. And, right. You know, which is why, you know, like one of the classic.
But so then maybe Tina's question is, did we lose something when we forgot that? Mm. Because we have allowed our movies and our TV shows to, or we've celebrated these movies and TV shows that talk about the willingness to kill instead of those TV shows and movies that, like they did maybe in the 40, 50 years ago, talked about the willingness to die.
Yeah. The willingness to risk for others. Right. And you know, Tony, cause that could have actually tactical consequences on the ground. Right. So an example of that, I know a guy was in Paktika province in Afghanistan and, he was a infantryman, right? So they're out every day patrolling through these towns. They're meeting with, you know, local village elders, right? And while they were there, Navy SEALs did a raid and they took out a Taliban commander. And then the SEALs saw that there was like a truck outside and there were three people sleeping under the truck. And they didn't know if the truck was related to the compound that they just raided, but they decided to call the people out. Three guys got out from under this truck where they were sleeping. Two of them raised their hands, one of them wouldn't. Sort of shouting commands to raise their hands. The guy doesn't do it. And so the SEALs shot the guy who didn't raise his hand. And it turned out that that was a, you know, teenager with a muscular degenerative disease and he couldn't raise his hands. Right. And, you know, when my friend, the unit was furious at the SEALs and the SEALs had this attitude like, you know, like we're not risking ourselves because some, you know, some guy, and he's like, you're, you know, the reason you joined to risk your life. And the person whose life really was at risk in that circumstance was not yours in a situation that you, a bunch of the best commanders in the world, you know, against three like teenagers totally controlled, but us. Because what's going to happen because you killed that teenager is the villages are going to be furious at us and we're going to face more IEDs and, you know, we're not going to get tips from the local population because they're going to be mad because you killed their family member, right? We're going to die because you were moral cowards. And I think that that aspect of a particular hard-edged, you know, vision of martial valor, which is about cruelty rather than toughness. And cruelty and toughness are different things, right? But where we actually sort of enjoy somebody who's got a kind of cruel edge to them, right? That, I think, is bad morally, but it's also bad tactically, especially in the kind of wars that we're fighting right now that rely, you know, we're all over the globe right now, and everywhere where we're operating, we rely on local partners, right? Because we're fighting asymmetric wars. So, you know, this is not World War II. This is not Korea. These are very different wars. And that kind of attitude will, in the long term, harm our national security, and it's going to get guys killed, and it's also just going to cause suffering.
Okay, Riley from Portland, Oregon, we'll do one more, wants to know, should more members of the military participate in politics?
Depends on the member of the
I'm
military.
I'm ready for this answer now.
I think it's good when they're veterans who participate in politics. But, you know, I also think that...
Why'd you laugh?
Well, no, because a question like that immediately calls to mind like the biggest knucklehead that you knew in the Marine Corps. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay. Not that one. Right.
Not that guy, you know.
Yeah, I can think of a few
I remember I was walking with a buddy of mine and we saw one of those like support the troops stickers. And he was like, I support most of the troops. I think it's good.
But you think generally it's a good idea to have people from the military
I think people who've done public service more generally, right? I think that, you know, we're talking about people talking about a sense of glory and I think that a sort of respect and devotion to the idea of public service more generally, not just in the military, but more generally, is something that we could do more, have more. Right. I think that's very important.
I mean, if you've offered to sacrifice, to make the ultimate sacrifice, yep, then one would believe, at least, or could believe that your desire to be in politics is not guided by fame or riches.
Sometimes.
You know, your motivation. Well, one could believe, is what I'm saying. I mean, obviously, there are a few who are there who are going to be
after something that they shouldn't be in the first place. A tremendous amount of respect for. I will certainly say that. Right. I think that
even people who I don't. I mean, yeah. I'm not an Adam Kinzinger voter necessarily, but people who have made that offer, mm-hmm, of the ultimate sacrifice, yeah, who've been willing to, who've loved the country enough to be willing to die if need be, probably are motivated by things other than fame and fortune and power by going into politics. I want to ask you, though, real quick before we wrap up, we'll make sure that people are well aware of your podcast, American Veteran Unforgettable Stories. Yeah. But also, why fiction? Mm-hmm. You won the National Book Award six years ago for your first, yep, book, but you've done quite a few since. And you use fiction to talk about a lot of these military and veteran stories, yeah, instead of nonfiction, which so many others do. What is it about writing fiction that do you think it's more effective in
getting people interested? Fiction allows you to do things you can't do in any other form, where you invite people into the skulls of other people and ask them to imagine themselves in these positions, right? And I think that's really deeply important. You know, I was talking to a veteran who suffers from post-traumatic stress. He had a traumatic brain injury. And he was saying, you know, I'll tell people what I've been through. And he's been through some things, as you can imagine. And he says, people will often tell me, and this is a thing veterans often hear, I can never imagine what you've been through. And he goes, it makes me mad because it's like, what if I want you to imagine what I've been through? What if it's important to me that you try? And I think that's related to why I write fiction, why I'm trying to write things that is open to civilian and veteran alike, to try and, you know, empathize with these characters, imagine themselves into that position, and then respond in some way. You know, I was talking to a couple, and the husband had been to Iraq, and they told me that they hadn't actually talked about his deployment. But when he read my book, and then he had his wife read my book, and he would read aloud to her story, and then they would discuss it, and he would start talking about his deployment. And that was like almost like the icebreaker, right? It was like the bridge. And that, to me, is probably the best compliment I've ever been given about my work, right? That it opens up that sort of connection where people, you know, maybe had difficulty finding it before, that place to actually begin that conversation.
And you got a lot of President Obama, I think, named your most recent book his one of his favorites of last year or of the year, Missionaries.
Yes, he did.
If you're listening, you can pick Missionaries up now in paperback. I had to correct myself a little earlier. The paperback version just came out, so you can grab that for your next flight since we're all able to fly now. How exciting. and you've got another one coming out next year, which we'd love to have you back because there's so many other questions that I've had on my mind as we've been talking. So when that next book comes out, come back. We'll talk about it. And I'll write down some of these questions that I haven't had a chance to ask tonight. But our goal here on this show is to get people from different backgrounds in politics to talk about things that we agree on, disagree on. Sometimes I'll fight a little bit harder than I did tonight, but you come from a background that is sort of universally respected by people, but also somewhat universally misunderstood by a lot of people also. And so what you're doing with letting veterans tell their stories on your podcast, American Veteran with No S, is remarkable for that reason. Thank you so much for doing it, but how do you think this country, which is so divided, there are so few things that we seem to agree on, your life and a lot of your mission with your podcast and writing about veterans in your books, sort of the one thing that we can agree on, in all the other stuff, how the heck are we going to get along?
I mean, that's the big question, right? I mean, for one thing, you know, stop treating politics as a sport. Remember that you're fellow Americans. You know, so it's Veterans Day today, but yesterday is the Marine Corps birthday, and I was hanging out with these group of Marines from all different walks of life. And one of the guys, he's got 100% disability, injured, multiple combat tours. And he was telling me, he was telling me about this guy. He named Sergeant Major Manny. He's like, Sergeant Major Manny, we hate each other politically. But that guy is one of the greatest, and I'm going to censor all the curse words that he used. Cause
you can say whatever the hell you want to here.
He's like, that guy, it would just expand it like 20 times.
I've never heard of a Marine not willing to cuss.
He's like,
come on now, Phil.
Fucking Marine, I have a fucking song with. I love that motherfucker, and I would go to any fucking war with him. And, heartening moment of overcoming partisan divides.
So cussing more. That's the
more
cussing with people
the
more. That's
Marine
how
Corps
the heck
answer is more profanity.
There you go. Hey, whatever works. It's done them well for 50 years. So thank you for that, Phil Clay. Thank you so much for being with us this week, and happy Veterans Day. And thank you for your service, and all those folks who you talk to. Please send our respect and our appreciation to them as well.
Thank you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.